Competition. You know, you'd be surprised at the number of times people like me hear the phrase, we've got a great product, but there's no competition. You know, it's just us. It's never, ever true. And the thing is, if it is true, either you really have hit on something that's very good and unique, or you're wrong. You know, there's no competition in what you do, because basically it isn't a very good thing to do. So think about the competition. A lot of people downplay their competition, but you know, you have to talk to your customer. You have to know your competition, and I'll come back to how you do that. But you have to talk to your customer, and you might be surprised how many times your customer considers things that are important that you don't actually think are important. Your product might not meet those things, but if your competitor does, then he wins. And I can't emphasize this enough. Industry and bank analysts are well informed. Pump them for information. Now, what I mean is you could go to some of those people who, you know, for your project or indeed for your company, you know, when you finish your MBA, you go off and form your company. You could buy market intelligence reports. They often cost thousands and thousands of dollars, and it's sometimes difficult to, you know, to afford as many as you would like, but maybe you can afford one or two. But the people who produce reports for free, and you can often get hold of them, are banks. There are people like Goldman and Morgan Stanley and Merrill. And all you need to do is to identify the market analyst, the market specialist in those companies, talk to them about how you're going to penetrate that market, you know, use some pizzazz, and you'd be surprised at how many of them will actually give you their knowledge, give you their reports. And some of them, you know, that thick on what's happening in your marketplace, in oil, in pharmaceuticals, in green technology, in software, in chips, in anything. And there are a few less now, but there used to be enough banks around for you to be able to tap up, you know, a good number of analysts. But there are less now, but presumably the best ones are still there. So nothing's more impressive than you giving a presentation to people you want to raise money from. And when you talk about the competition, to explain how actually some of them are slightly better than you in some areas, but mostly you're better than them. But to do it, you know, competitor by competitor, because as I say, bottom line is if you say there aren't any or there's not much competition, absolutely nobody will believe you. And this is what we did, and actually we at CSR, we got a large amount of information from those banks, some of which in those early heady days, you know, wanted to be our friends and wanted to help us float. It's not quite the same now, because flotation is not quite as much on the cards as it used to be some years ago. And indeed, we did buy a few reports as well. So, these were the big competitors that we saw. And we ranked those against the lead in acquiring Bluetooth inside knowledge. Obviously, Ericsson was way at the top because it was part of the Bluetooth standards group. And the degree and ability to actually occupy our space, which was sort of up there. And some of the larger companies, you know, were a sort of a little slow moving and not quite able to move up there that fast. That's what we said. I mean, when we said this, of course, we didn't know what the answer would be. But, you know, you need a story. And you need a story for two reasons. You need a story because it's something that you can use to structure your thinking, but it's also a story that you can tell others. You know, it's like the, and I'm sure you've had talks on this, like the elevator pitch. You know, you need an elevator pitch because you need an elevator pitch. You need, you know, 2 minutes to tell people why you're there, why they should back your company. But, you know, in a more complex way, you also need other stories. And just to go on from this, you know, there's some of the other companies. And it, indeed, we didn't list them all, but there were probably another 50% again who were in Bluetooth, who were saying, we will do Bluetooth. And, you know, there were we in there amongst those, and we were saying, we're doing Bluetooth, we'll be the market leader. And by the way, we're 9 people in Cambridge, you know, so you can imagine quite often we didn't get much of a hearing. But we persevered, we raised the money, and indeed, of all those companies you see here and on the previous slide, there are only two or three that exist now. Some of those companies were doing software. They're producing Bluetooth software stacks. Some were licensing intellectual property, including some local companies. And some, like us, were saying, we will do chips. And there were some, like Intel, who were sort of pretty much saying, we'll do chips and we'll manufacture the chips ourselves, you know. So anyway, lots of competition. But I think the message here is, so what? Lots of competition. Yeah, we should have been worried by those big names there. But if you think you've got something that's good and unique, persevere and, you know, have confidence.
Phil, thanks.
Yes.
Take you back a moment. I mean, there's two points that come out. One is that you've said two or three times now, there's nine of you there, and you're taking on, you know, the sort of David and Goliath thing.
Yeah.
But presumably the nine people have huge credibility in the industry anyway for their either intellectual horsepower, or they were well-known, well-respected engineers, or the trust of people with an open door. So something was going on with that team of nine that gave it some kind of edge to be able to get in.
I think the answer is yes and no. I was the oldest. At the time we started CSR, I was 49. James Collier, I think, next oldest. In my background, worked in telecommunications, STC, ITT, had been a consultant, understood software, understood generically technology, you know, could run a spreadsheet, could give a presentation, could manage people. James Collier was about 8 years younger than me, or maybe 10. He was a superb technologist. He's still the CTO of Cambridge Silicon Radio. But in terms of knowledge, reputation in the field, if he'd stood up at a wireless conference, people would have said, James who? But actually what he had, besides excellent ability, was through the work at Cambridge Consultants, and actually, you know, the technology consulting companies are great companies to work for, and indeed to do such a thing, to spin out ventures. But what he had done for clients, second-tier clients in the consumer products industry, is create chips, moderately simple chips, but some wireless chips, using third-party semiconductor company, companies that made chips, like ST Microelectronics in France. And at the time, just before we spun out, and indeed afterwards, we were pushing the boundaries so far as the use of silicon was concerned. When you use silicon, you have silicon models that tell you how the silicon will operate at certain frequencies. And at the time, the models only operated up to about, I think, 1 gigahertz. So we said to ST Microelectronics, we want to make some chips, and indeed to the people we pitched to, and we will work this silicon at 2.4 gigahertz. So the models didn't exist as to how to use the silicon, but at Cambridge Consultants, James and his team had developed their own models in their own time, and reckoned they knew that standard CMOS would work at those frequencies. So it was a bit of a punt, but, you know, we thought it would. Glenn Collinson, the three founding directors were me, James and Glenn. Glenn was a bit younger than James, worked for a number of large companies, including TI. Very good technologist, but we gave him the marketing role because he could talk very well about the technology. And indeed, you know, one of his skills, I think one of our skills for all of us, were very focused. You have to be very focused and not look either side. The engineers, the six engineers who make up the nine, were all quite young, all early 20s, mid-20s. I think the oldest was about 28, 29. No, one was a little older, but five were below 30. So actually, we didn't have big, grand reputations, but we understood all that it took to found a company, to raise money, and to do the technology and marketing things we needed to be a success.
So deep domain expertise, really, with market expertise, industry experience.
Industry experience and silicon domain experience. But, you know, it's always pros and cons, as you know. So those skills that we had enabled us to pitch for money and indeed stand up in front of potential customers and say, this is what we're doing, you need our chip, this is what you can do with it to make your products work. On the other hand, and I won't say who it was, one of those VCs who backed us initially, he told us afterwards, said, okay, I like those guys, but do I want to put money into a bunch of consultants? You know, they have industry experience, but it's not current industry experience. They're coming from a consulting company. We don't back consulting companies, we back product companies. So they had that worry themselves. But luckily they overcame that worry. So I think the message is, you don't have to be a world expert. You don't have to have written 55 books. You do need experience. And, yeah.
So that question is related to a session on Teams, which is due to come.
Okay.
Time.
Yeah.
The other commentary...
Who's doing that one?
I'll be...
Okay.
And I just wanted to be able to hook back to your comment.
Right. Right.
The other part of it is comparative strategy. You said, so there's a lot of competitors. Then you said, so what? Now,
yes. Did I say that?
You did.
Okay.
Without the
video. Right, I can't deny it, can I?
The interesting thing is, of course, business school territory is full of diagnostic tools like SWOT and
yes.
Test and Porter and so on.
Yes.
And the whole thing about the Michael Porter thing on competitive strategy is what are you going to do to compete?
Yes.
And yet, you've said three or four times, really, yeah, there are big players, there are big competitors.
Yes.
But kind of, if you have your own belief in what you're doing,
yes.
You can press ahead. So you, and you said also you did a lot of analysis.
Yes.
And I'm sure the VCs did.
They did, absolutely.
They looked at MBA's work.
They paid people to do analysis, and quite often when you're raising, you know, a fair amount of money, the VCs, who are mostly not domain experts, will pay people money to do some research on your company. And in fact, the guy that they, there were three guys, but one of the guys that was paid was a colleague of myself and Paul called Ian Vance, who at the time... Sir Ian, indeed now, was the chief scientist of STC, somebody who's superbly capable in radio and has a known reputation. And I think one of his comments, I hope I haven't got him wrong, was, this is a very difficult thing to do, what they are aiming to do, but if there's any team in the world that can do it, this is a team, this is one of those teams that could do it. And I guess he was proved right.
And so then it comes down to the perception of risk beyond that.
It does. And let me just say, it's a flip thing to say, perhaps. But when we were founding CSR, you know, we were talking to our colleagues in Cambridge Consultants. The nine of us spun out, nine of us joined, formed, made CSR. There were a couple of people who had MBAs who analysed the opportunity and didn't actually join us. And they, spent a fair bit of time analysing. You probably, as an MBA, have all heard this phrase, paralysis by analysis. So I'm hoping...
That's what I was alluding
to. I know you were, very delicately, so I thought I'd rise to the bait.
Thank you.
You have, as MBAs... and with your training and intellect, the ability to use a host of tools, a range of tools to analyse a problem. And at some stage, though, you must decide that you've finished your analysis and it's helped you get to where you are, and you then go and do it. As you're doing it, you may have thoughts that actually you've taken the wrong path, in which case, if you can, modify that path. And indeed, if you find or you think you've taken the wrong path, stop. But I think the point I'm making is you can spend... there has to be a balance between the amount of analysis you do and then how much you actually use your gut that says, OK, I believe that this is the right thing to do. I'm now going to do it. And I'm going to do it till I've finished.
This was your differentiator against Ericsson at the time.
Ericsson was it?
Was too big. There are too many people who are analysing against several different product areas.
Right.
Several different R&D groups across three continents.
Ah.
So whilst we had all the resources to
definitely
support anybody coming in,
definitely
the ability to focus it and actually target the market opportunity and drive it with the same coherence that the team was driving
right.
was almost done. And it's still the case with larger players, so they are overrated in some
degrees. Yeah. Okay, well, there you have the other side of the story.
I do like really interesting.
Yes.
Really interesting because, you know, the story would be an MBA assignment. You know, why would you enter this market? Ericsson are already there. And here you have the voice of Ericsson saying, well, actually, this is what was going on inside. And you're saying, have the entrepreneurial self-belief.
Yes.
Well, it's cheaper for us to buy a company with good, coherent IPR and a
yes.
good team.
Yes.
Or to use a good team for
yes.
product implementation, often than getting our own resources to focus on the delivery.
Actually, a good number of those teams you saw there, the competitors, those companies were bought by the bigger companies in order to give them either a position in Bluetooth to create their own chips or an understanding of Bluetooth to use other people's. So, you know, there was consolidation in the market, and a lot of the companies who didn't actually make it actually were bought for some very good prices. So they did make everybody money too. It's just that that was the end of their life.
There was a debate many years ago, I can't remember the author, but sort of the Japanese school of thought versus the US school of thought. The Japanese school of thought went, you know, if you know your product is going to serve the needs of a customer, just press on with that. Don't worry about competition because that kind of take care of itself.
Right.
The US school of thought, this textbook, I have to try and remember the name, was you try to map out your competitors and you wipe them out.
Yeah, 50%.
That kind of thing. So there was one was very aggressive anti-competitive strategy and stuff. And the other one was, well, don't worry about competition. You just focus on your customer needs.
Interesting.
It seemed to me that, in a way, the CSR strategy in the early days was just focus on doing that.
Yes.
And don't worry about the noise in the background.
Yes, yes.
And so in terms of the analysis that everyone's going to be doing here,
yes.
is, you know, again, do we have a clear focus on what people want?
Yes. And, you know, it's a fine line, isn't it? But I know that when we were in the early days of CSR, you know, there were so many people, including people from our investors, who were saying, well, look, so-and-so is getting on this other company. You know, aren't you worried about them? Or what about so-and-so over there? They've just made an announcement. And you have to take note of that. But if you were to worry about everything, you know, you would never start, I think. Oh, sorry.
Behind me.
Yeah, yes.
But then you know that if you were to make this chip, it would require that much money. You didn't know about the fabulous model before that.
Yes.
So you knew that these other companies could easily wipe you out because they could design the chip and they could make the chip.
That's true. If companies like Intel or Motorola, who had their own fabs, did the design and made the chip, then they would have less margin to pay the people who made our chip, so theoretically they could produce a cheaper chip because, you know, the manufacturing is inside their own companies. Motorola bought one of those early startups called DigiAnswer in order to give them because they didn't have, when Bluetooth was announced, they didn't really have any capability that area or experience, so they bought a company, but, you know, for whatever reason, it didn't work. I won't mention the name of the company, but there was another, not Motorola, but there was another large semiconductor company that when it saw that Bluetooth was probably going to be pretty important, it bought two or three companies and it moved them from one part of the world to another. Hey, then it moved them back again. And, you know, what do you think happened to the staff? So, you know, big companies are capable of doing some very good things, but on the other hand, like the battleship, you know, there are some things they don't do well.
But I mean, you as a startup, you have to look at competitive landscape because you might be burning so much cash and get nothing out of it.
Yes.
In a way, you've got to knock these big players coming in.
Yes.
You know it's a standard.
Yes.
You know it's important. You know that because everyone is going to use it, it's going to be embedded in the world, not just now, but for 20, 30 years to come.
Yes.
Once it's embedded, it's hard to pull out whether people talk of wireless USB. It's not
yes.
going to come.
Yes.
It's impossible.
Yes.
So you know this big player will come so strongly against you, so don't you worry about it?
No. Well, yes, of course, yes, do worry. But the reason you, and you know, this is perhaps specific to the semiconductor consumer products market, the reason you shouldn't maybe worry yourself to death is, for example, about that time, Nokia, for example, were saying, what sort of company are we? Are we a company that makes everything that goes in our mobile phone, or are we basically a consumer products plastic box maker who provides telecommunications service to our customers? So once it starts saying that, the corollary of that, and you guys with your tools can, you know, analyze this, once they start saying that, really what they're saying is, we're not going to make everything that goes in our mobile phones. So, therefore, people like CSR, who can make the best Bluetooth chips in the world, are customers of Nokia, because Nokia buys the CSR chips to put in their phone. Most of the world doesn't know that CSR chips are in the Nokia phones. But really, we saw, I think, from an early stage, with pointers like that and others, that Nokia would not be a competitor. It would be our customer. And so it turned out.
Can I just add?
Yes.
One of the key success stories for ARM is
yes.
that these big companies, Apple and others, decided that ARM is the best company to actually supply the
processor cores.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. That's right. You know, till ARM came along, which was, you know, sort of mid to late 90s, all the semiconductor companies were designing their own processor cores. Intel, Motorola, National, TI. And, you know, it takes significant effort, big teams. But if there's an industry standard, like the ARM processor, that everybody starts using and everybody starts buying, not only is it good for those that make the chips, because they can buy software engineers and there are applications written for somebody else's phone that runs on their phone. So, basically, it's good for the industry that there is a standard, and the big companies are happy to shed some of that focus and put some of those engineers, internal engineers, on other projects. So, yes, ARM saw this coming. But, of course, ARM, you know, like CSR, could put up an equivalent chart that says mid-95, you know, we had 20 competitors. There aren't 20 competitors now, but there were then. And this is what we did. And it does, you know, for those who aren't electrical engineers... doesn't look much, but actually at the time, and indeed even now, it was very world-beating, and that's what we got the McRobert Gold Medal for. And that is one piece of silicon, and actually that's the other story, I won't spend long on it, but standard silicon, CMOS, complementary metal oxide semiconductor. About 99% of the world's chips are made of CMOS. Some of our competitors at the time we started the company were using exotic technologies like... BiCMOS, you know, silicon on insulator, which gave you better performance but were more costly. So at the end of the day, when our performance after tuning reached theirs, we were far cheaper. So what we did is we put a radio, you know what a radio is, it's lots of analog bits and pieces, on one piece of silicon with digits, you know, AND gates, NOR gates, microprocessor cores, and software on the one piece of silicon, and that's what we sold, that's what we sell to customers. And these are some of the difficult things to do, the electronic engineering type things that made it actually quite difficult. So that's why when Glenn and I stood up at the front of a big auditorium in America and said, this is what we're doing, at 2.4 gigahertz, people said, don't believe you, not possible. And there was one large semiconductor company, whose name I won't mention, who for years after we started, you know, till 2002, 2003, said CSR, you know, they say they're doing this, they won't do it. And then when we'd done it, they said, okay, they may have done it now, we'll soon do it better. They never actually did do it at all. But, you know, their marketing people could just not believe that a small company in Cambridge could beat this large global semiconductor company who they thought was better than everybody else. And I won't mention their name.